Breakfast Business
with Enterprise Ireland
on Newstalk.
Trini Woodall and her entourage swept into town at the end of last week, ostensibly to launch her skincare range, Trini London, here in Ireland. Hundreds turned out to see the former presenter of What Not to Wear in Brown Thomas and Arnott's. She's a branding and social media phenomenon who is also quite a successful businesswoman. I sat down for a chat with her in her glistening silver jumpsuit and began by asking whether it was true that she had sold her house and her possessions to start the business.
I'm here to bring it into retail in Ireland because I think we do online here, but many Irish women love the joy of the camaraderie of going shopping together, going out as a social experience, especially post-COVID. We want back those social experiences.
Yeah, we do.
And so now I think we're of a time in the brand where we now come to the customer. The customer was coming to us. They would go through thick treacle, go online, people who'd never done online personalization. And so those women talk to their friends who are people who shop in store. So Brown Thomas said, will you come into our store? And we said, we'd love to.
It's a premium product. I'm not sure every household can afford it.
Interestingly, last night we had a Trini Tribe event. And I think because we're a brand that people trust, I had at that event four women nurses from Cork who'd carpooled to get there to the event, where I know they spend a proportion of their salary on our products. So I don't want to let them down. They made a big investment and trusted us that we'll help them. And then I'll have a woman who goes to Brown Thomas every day. And I have it runs the that gamut.
I read somewhere that you sold your house and some of your possessions to start up the business. Is that accurate?
That's true. That's totally true.
Does that not say that the banks had absolutely no faith on someone with a really high profile? That's very damaging for the banks, isn't it?
No, I at the time didn't. I was coming out of, I was about 3 years out of working in England. I worked abroad and I'd bought a house I'd dreamt of for years when I was on my highest salary. So I got a big mortgage. And then I worked abroad because there was no work in England, being paid probably half the salary. And then after 3 years there, it sort of cemented the idea I had, which I'd had for about 4 years of, of Trini London, came back and I thought now is the time. And it's never, you know, you never start something when you really want to do it at the time when it's best in your life aesthetically, when you have lots of money in the bank. Many entrepreneurs don't start in that position. So I started when I knew I was in debt. I couldn't afford to have debt and focus on the business at the same time. So I started off by renting out my house. Then I sold clothes. I worked in fashion for years. So I built up some clothes. I'd done an SEIS scheme as well to raise some money from two people who you can do a scheme in the UK, which is a tax incentive scheme. But I was doing formulations. I was building the prototype. So I ate into that. And so there was that point where I really needed to think, these things are things I've felt I wanted that were so materialistic to me, and now they're just material possessions. And so I knew that's what I had to do. And it
was not. Some people struggle to part with possessions, don't they?
I think you struggle with the concept that you're going to have to part with it. But once you make the decision, you just part with it because you see the future of what it will bring you. And I think before you see the potential future of what it will bring you, it's much harder to part with it.
Entrepreneurialism runs in the family. Your granddad was in the steel business, I read.
Yeah.
So risk-taking runs in the family as well.
Yeah, he started as he worked for Lithgow as a junior shipbuilder on the shop floor. And he ended up being the head of British Steel during the war in England.
So he must have been useful at something. Going
he
and,
was.
And he must have passed something down the genetic tree. What have you learned about entrepreneurialism and about yourself when it comes to doing business?
That it's okay to fail. And I had lots
of
things.
Is it still okay to fail in the UK and Europe? Everyone does it in America. Donald Trump's been bankrupt three or four times.
Yes,
but
I think
in Europe, is it still, is it okay to fail?
I have, and I'm back here where I am now and further than I'd been before. But I started something at 17 when I was still at school, a little business which had a moment, and then, you know, I think I thought, what do I do now? Do I get a proper job or do I continue with this? And I was too young to take that jump into full entrepreneurship. Then when I was in my early 20s, I started a sock business, selling socks to people in the city. But it was sort of did it well, but bought bad products. So I learned from that. That was a bad thing to do. Then in 99, I became obsessed with the internet. There was not e-commerce then, but there was people who were desperate to invest in things. And I had this destination for women. And I thought at some stage I will have a path to profitability. So I raised 7.5 million in 4 months.
1999.
Chunk of change, and built up a business over 2 years. And then in year three, I had to let everyone go. So I think what I learned, I learned so much from that moment, that when I started Trini London, I thought, I know what I will not do. I won't raise money too early. I won't let people who are really experienced come in too early, who will sort of guide me in what they think this business should be when I've started this business as an entrepreneur, thinking this is what I think people need. Mm. You need enough time by yourself and with a few people to cement that idea and make it so strong and possible that then you are at the right stage when you bring in people with more experience who can actually go into, you know, details of e-com, CMOs, higher up the funnel, lower down the funnel, you know, all the bits where they will know more than you. So I probably spent 4 years in the business knowing more than anyone else in the business. And I'm now at a stage where we have 1.2 million customers in 180 countries. And so I need some really good people who are, well, I've had for the last 2 years that building up, but now we're at that next level. So I want to see a head of retail, a head of commercial, you know, and get that seniority in the business.
Quite a few entrepreneurs start a company but can't run it. And they sometimes need to be edged out of their own business. Mm-hmm. I presume you don't want to be in that boat. What do you learn from the likes of Stelios Hagiano and other people who've been thrown out of their own companies?
What you learn is, as a CEO, you've got to keep learning. You can't always think that you're ultimately right about everything. And I think when you have a business where you begin to get a big board, they start to think, actually, is that the right thing? So two things. I have quite a small board, but also I have
perfectly formed, I'm sure.
Well, it's a good board. And I have a CEO coach. And 2 years ago, I thought, I need to learn how to be a really good CEO. A habit I did a lot is, and this was, he did this analogy to me, which really taught me a lot. He said, you're the dragon's head at Chinese New Year. And you think about all these things you want to do and you race there. And all your team are in the whole body of the dragon. And when you race that way and then you sort of see something over there and you race that way, the people right at the back only just catching up with that. So you have to bring people on the journey.
And maybe not.
And look behind.
Suddenly.
Yeah. And look behind and check they're on board. So every time I speak to him, which is once a month at the moment, I learn what am I doing right and what do I need to improve. And I think it's that we should never think we're fully formed. We're never fully formed. We're always learning stuff.
I can absolutely concur with that. Back to the what not to wear days, the Daily Mail very unfairly described you guys as the creators of rude TV.
Mm-hmm.
How is it now in a kind of post-Me Too world? It's very difficult to say to someone's face, you look awful in that.
But I think we never would have said exactly that. We would have said...
I'm sure you were far more diplomatic.
No, but it's more we would have said, that yellow top does nothing for you. Hmm. Right? There's just a way we phrased it. You would never make that TV nowadays. It's of its time. It needs to stay of its time and of its time. It was innovative. I meet countless people in Ireland who said, I learned how to do this by watching that show, which I like. And you'd never have a husband say, yes, please put a secret camera in my wife's bedroom. You know, it's like, no way would you be able to do that now. But that was a different time.
But how do you be brutally honest with people if you can't wound them or at least be blunt with them?
You don't have to be blunt to get to a place where somebody can begin to look at something that maybe you just find them at the right time where they might want to look at something. And you just give them some suggestions of things to make them think, maybe I want to change this or move forward. Or some people are just looking for a sign. Some people have done the same thing for a long time, whether it's wearing the same makeup or never having a skincare routine, or just they do the same thing because it's safe and it's what they know. And then you just come in and say, I think my language changed. I would sort of say, you got to do this, it's great. Mm. But now my conversation on, you know, we have a few million people on social, is say, consider this concept. It's just a different language.
Delicately wrap what you need to say. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's a way of putting it. I wrap it, but I'm wrapping something brutally. I'm just thinking, we need a language where we can speak to each other and gain trust. So what is that language?
Final question. Are consumers different everywhere, or is there a universality about consumption patterns? I mean, you're here now in Ireland. You started your business in the UK. You know the UK better than anyone else. Have you noticed something that transcends all markets when it comes to consumption patterns?
I think consumption patterns are 50% localized market and 50% how the target market you're addressing thinks locally or globally. So what I learned from stopping to do TV in the UK and doing around the world, and I did like 12 countries, is how women tend to think about things is a universal thing. It doesn't matter your religion, your age, your ethnicity. You have certain thoughts around things and they're the same. So talking emotionally to somebody, no different. Then the other 50% is a global economics, and we're in a recession, and so what's important? And you might have things you hear about like the lipstick index, but still, it's still a measured choice to decide to buy something that's just for you and frivolous. So how do you talk in the language when it's something where every choice financially is a committed decision that you might give somebody permission to say, do something for yourself, actually, because it makes you feel good about yourself, and therefore for those people who need you in their life, you feel good about yourself, you care about yourself, and so you impart the best part of you. And it's not as superficial, you know, consumerism that might be in how you talk to people, everything, but it is an element of what we choose to buy to make our life feel better.
Trini, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Breakfast Business
with Enterprise Ireland
on News Talk.